Today, we bring you another edition of City Talk with Mayor Jeremy Grimm. Good morning, Mayor Grimm.
Hey, good morning out there in Radio Land. Good morning, Chris and Susie. Great to be here, as always.
Mayor Grimm, thank you for being here.
You bet. Anytime. It's always a pleasure to come down and both inform and, hopefully provide some clarity on what's going on in the city.
Well, the city's been going through the budget process, and it's always a lot of discussion and very little public participation, it seems like, typically in most years. How has the process gone this year? And give us an outline of what the budget has in it.
Sure. So the process this year, it went very smoothly. I have to really take my hat off and thank staff. You know, our finance director, Sarah Linz, just does an amazing job. She's been doing this for, I think about nine years now. So she's got it down pretty well. And it starts, if you're not aware, it starts actually back in, late February with staff and preparing each department's, budget, looking at needs, looking at backlogs, things to that effect, projects that are coming up. And then it evolves several iterations that happen all the way through March, April, May, when the council starts to meet with me individually. I meet with each council member, really go through the budget with them, try to hear about their priorities, what their concerns are. And then finally, it starts to come into the public realm in June, July, and August. So, it's a really transparent process. One of the things, if you're not aware, go to the City of Sandpoint's website, and right there, either click on fiscal or budget links, and there's a really amazing transparent website that walks through every fund that we have, every revenue source that we have, shows how all the money's coming in and going out and every project we're going to be funding this year. The big picture, when we look at the budget this year, it was my first budget as mayor. And overall, it was a decrease of the previous year's budget by about 5%. The budget's about $50.5 million. And It really reflects my priorities because I set the initial budget and the council effectively confirms or affirms it. When we look at the budget this year, the highlights, I'll say, are first and foremost, we were successful at decoupling from the joint powers agreement that we had with the fire districts. So we lost a total of 17 and a half employees. 16 of those came from that fire district partnership. So that's a big thing for us because that's, 16 employees that are our HR and our payroll and our administration isn't having to process every week. And that's a lot just of capacity for our staff.
Was this change in that relationship and the loss of the 16 employees amicable? Was this known it was happening and it was going to come up? And
yeah, so they actually didn't lose their jobs. They right. just transferred back to those fire districts that they work for. Mm-hmm. That Selkirk joint powers agreement basically rolled all those employees under Sandpoint's umbrella. And that was one of the points of contention, at least for me, that was taking up a lot of our capacity and bandwidth at City Hall. So, was it amicable? Yes, I would say so. We still will be working and training with those fire districts, Selkirk and, Sagal and Westside. So we still have some coordinated activities, but those employees didn't lose their jobs. They just went back to their homes, so to speak.
And you have a mutual assistance. If a big fire broke right. out, the districts help each other, right?
Yeah, mutual aid. I got to tell you, I did have a pause because I broke the vote on that decision to decouple. It was, as mayor, you rarely get to vote unless there's a tie of the council. So to decouple from the joint powers agreement, that was one of those circumstances where it was a tie and I got to break that vote. And my vote was to decouple and basically go back to the way it's been for, decades, just a Sandpoint fire department with, 10 employees, 9 firefighters and a chief. So right after that, I'm out on the 4th of July and enjoying my family and friends and get the call. And I'm driving into town, of course, see, you know, Fifth Ave just billowing with smoke, you know, the Army surplus. And my thought was, oh, my gosh, this is going to be the test. Did I make a really bad decision? And I get there and it was amazing. You know, those fire districts did an incredible job. They were all there coordinating, working together. I bring that up because, yes, despite the fact that we've decoupled and we're now just a single fire department, Sandpoint city limits only, we do have those mutual aid protections where we will help our neighbors and our neighbors come in and help us. So, yeah, that's sort of the one of the elements getting back to the budget. So we've decreased a total of 17 and a half employees net. If you take the fire personnel out, 1.5. So no one lost their job over that. We obviously eliminated the city administrator position, which was a priority for me when running for mayor. And then we were able to consolidate some other positions, primarily an asset manager who looks at, you know, your roads and your sewer lines and your water lines and your infrastructure. And we consolidated that into a central services director. So other highlights of the budget, as I mentioned, it was a 5% decrease in the budget, but the budget really reflects my priorities of focusing on core infrastructure, sort of meat and potato, you know, simple elements that maintain and make a city run, you know, roads, water, sewer. So when we look at those areas of spending, the budget has a 87% increase in spending on our streets and sidewalks this year. That goes up to $8.9 million. A 27% increase in wastewater or sewer spending up to about $7.3 million, and a 97% increase in water projects and water spending up to $3.75 million. So I really worked with staff hard to say, what do we do to pivot away from sort of the previous trend, which was amenities and plans and visioning and, you know, big park projects, and really direct all of our available revenue towards just basic infrastructure, sewer, water, streets, and in my opinion, my philosophical perspective, that's our role, you know, fire, police, and infrastructure and land use planning. If we do all that, then the private sector, in my mind, can flourish and our community can build. That's what the private sector does, is it does all the other stuff. So, yeah, I'm excited that it's adopted, and we've got a few more days left in the existing fiscal year. The new fiscal year starts October 1st.
Mm-hmm. So your emphasis is on infrastructure, and actually we're seeing a lot of streets getting some repairs right now.
Yeah.
Although it is just kind of patchwork on many of them.
It is.
Yeah. And there is a big need to do a lot of road work. And, of course, we have the wastewater treatment plan.
Yes.
I believe this budget includes some engineering studies for that.
That's right. So when we look at those infrastructure needs, I'll start with the wastewater. You know, we have entered into a contract with Keller & Associates, a Idaho engineering firm that does wastewater design and engineering all over the state and the country. So they are working right now on something called a preliminary engineering report. This report will give us basically direction on what technology to use. If you aren't aware, wastewater treatment, it's like going into a supermarket. There's all sorts of different things you can do to your wastewater and treat it in different ways. And they all have different costs and pros and cons. So that's going to be the first thing that they do, is they look at what treatment technology are we going to be using there. Unlike our existing plant, many of the new treatment technologies are virtually odorless. So that's going to be one of the big benefits. But the other big benefit, of course, is you know, clean water. If you're not aware out there, we unfortunately have a wastewater plant that dates from World War II. That era, And it's well beyond its useful life. It literally breaks down every week. There's something breaking, and the parts are impossible to build or find. So often our plant operators are out there like a MacGyver, manufacturing their own, stopgap, solutions to switches and pumps and other things that just don't exist today, the way that they're installed there. So that preliminary engineering report will, as I mentioned, identify the technology. And then it's going to also identify how do we approach this? Do we do what we call a turnkey, sort of replace the whole plant in one big project? Or is it more of an incremental piece-by-piece replacement? For instance, do we work on the disinfection portion of the plant first? And then do we do the clarifiers? And then do we do the intake, what they call the headworks? So that report will be completed sometime in late December. And that's also going to have a preliminary budget or cost estimate. And that's really important because we will then take that cost estimate to the state in early January. And that's when the state starts to line out and prioritize what projects in the state for wastewater they're going to fund. So once that gets into the state, we'll have the technology, we'll have the process, and we'll have the cost estimate. And then it is literally out there, knocking on doors to and looking for partners, rural development, federal funding, state funding. All of this will occur over the next few months. And then I expect in May to come to the voters on the ballot with a election question, which is going to be for a bond to support the construction of the wastewater plant, whatever that design is.
So that would be sometime next year?
Yes, May. I'm anticipating that will be coming in May.
Okay. And we don't know what that price tag might be until this preliminary work is done.
Correct. We don't.
This can be darn big.
It's significant. The city had previously looked at some high level numbers, somewhere between 60 and, $90 million is probably what this is going to run.
So the state is going to possibly fund part of that.
That's the goal. Yes. Yeah. State and federal government through grants. I mean, loans are easy to come by. It's the grants. That's the big one. And a grant, if you're not aware, grants, you don't have to repay.
Mm-hmm. So if we do put forward a bond, it's going to be for the difference between what you can secure through grants and government funding and what we need to make up from our local tax base. Yeah.
Based on my conversations with the head of the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality, we actually have to bond for the full amount. And then they look at what that does to our rates. And if our rates aren't sufficient to cover that bond cost, they look at the household income, the average household income, and they look at what our rates do, how much they have to go up. And then they say if they go up beyond a certain percentage of household income, that's where they really start to bring in the grants. They obviously don't want to make this unaffordable for our residents. I will say on this that the previous administration, we've had two sewer rate increases in the past 5 years. Those have put us in a position where we can support quite a bit of debt service, so to speak. So we're in good shape in terms of our rates. There's one more bump to the rates anticipated next year. And that the plan then was to have those rates be able to support debt service of about $60 million.
Right. I'm thinking about, is there any federal funding with the infrastructure bills and things coming out?
Yeah. The timing is not ideal. If we had done this 3 years ago with all the recovery money and the federal money, states and the feds were literally awash in infrastructure money. It's not the case today. So I am actively working with our congressional and Senate delegations and the governor's office and the head of DEQ. We will be working like crazy to make sure that we can get as much federal funding for this project as possible. Because at the end of the day, it comes down to clean water. We all we all love and live on and need water, and clean water is essential. And for example, this last year, we've put E. coli in the river. We've exceeded chlorine limits in the river. So what's happening right now is not healthy for our environment. It's not healthy for the water. And we want to fix that. And it's our obligation to do that. So we'll tackle that. And hopefully, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, we'll have a new system down there that meets our requirements and will handle growth for the next, you know, 25 years, 30 years. The other big one is our streets. So
before we get onto that, so you mentioned we have some instances in which we've basically polluted the river that typically happens when there's a big stormwater surge, right?
Yeah. One of the problems with our environment here, unlike say if you're familiar with the Rathdrum Prairie and Coeur d'Alene or Post Falls, we sit on about 300 feet of clay. They sit on gravel alluvial that water hits the land down in Coeur d'Alene in the Rathdrum Prairie and it goes down. In Sandpoint, water hits the surface and it doesn't go down. It goes sideways out to the river. So when we get rain on snow events in Sandpoint, the rainwater or that water literally hits the ground. It migrates to its lowest point, which is typically our sewer lines. And then it flows either along those pipes or because they're old, it finds cracks in those pipes and it inflows into our sewer system. We then have to treat what would be rainwater or rain on snow. So the numbers, just to visualize this, in an August day, we might do 1.5 million gallons a day of sewer water that we treat. On a rain on snow event, that number in the last few years went up to, you know, north of 10, 12 million gallons a day. So our plant...
10 times factor.
Oh, yes. 10, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So this actually ties into our roads too. But when that water, when our plant's working in August, it takes about 9 hours for a drop of sewage to go through the plant, be treated, and then flow out to the river in a safe state. When we get those rain on snow events, that happens in about 45 minutes. They literally are just the water, the sewage is just passing through the plant. They try their best. The system just can't handle that volume of sewage. So on those days, our operators are down there turning up the chlorine, trying to kill the E. coli and the bugs as best they can. But simply the fact of the matter is it's not enough. Now, to try to fix that problem, and that problem is referred to as I&I, inflow and infiltration. You'll hear that term sometimes. So you'll notice many of our streets, you drive down them and it's bump, 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 bump. And those are what we call sewer laterals.
We have noticed that.
Our sewer lines run in the streets generally, and then each home is serviced off that sewer lateral, that sewer line. And we have a program when you sell a home, you have to videotape your sewer lateral. And if those laterals are old, some of them, due to the age of the town, are actually made out of clay and, you know, literally ceramic pipe. Sometimes they've collapsed, they've broken because we have shifts in the earth. And so we videotape those when a house is sold. If they're cracked and leaking, then the homeowner has to replace them. And we do that at the time of home sale because we figure that there's some financing and maybe some profit and people can handle that. So when they find those cracked pipes and broken sewer laterals, we replace them, and that cuts into the street. And then when you cut a street, that patch is never as good as the original surface. So that's one of the reasons we have all these thump-thumps as you drive through our streets. The good news is that we've made great progress reducing that inflow and infiltration into our sewer lines by replacing these pipes. But it's still not enough. Throughout town, we all know people who have maybe a sump pump in their basement or their crawl space that goes into their sewer or a storm drain somewhere. So unless we went door to door and did something called a smoke test, where they actually put smoke in the sewer line and see where it comes out. We're not going to get rid of all that inflow and infiltration, that INI in the system. So the low-hanging fruit has been cured. We've reduced those peak flows of our inflow and those rain on snow events tremendously, but they're still significant and something we just have to live with in due to our composition of our soils here. So the new plant design will be designed to basically I'll call it a large swimming pool on the front of it. So that will serve as a sort of a collection point or a buffer when we get those high flows. They call it an attenuation tank, and it will basically be a multi-million gallon pool that holds those high flows, and then the plant can process it at a normal rate over the next, you know, couple of days. So, yeah, that's sort of sewer.
I'm just thinking, listening to you talk, you've become an expert on city municipal sewer systems. And
he does have a planning background.
He had
a head start here.
Yeah, I had a head start. I tell you, one of the things, I've been working on land use planning and infrastructure for since 2003 and professionally. So I can't imagine sitting in the mayor's seat without decades of background on this stuff. It is challenging, but without that background, it would be really challenging.
And working on this in a proactive way will really look at the future in a good way for this community.
Yeah, we don't want to kick the can down the road any further. You know, we've known this sewer plant is on its last breath for well over a decade. And it's just, it's come to a point where, I just signed a settlement with the Environmental Protection Agency for our violations into the river. We need to fix it. It's just, it's not a matter of, discretion anymore. It's something we have to do.
Right. It's at the top of the list.
Absolutely. Followed by our streets.
Streets. Well, you just explained that these laterals for the sewer are creating a lot of the problems we have with torn up streets. But there was a study done by the city in 2020. It was a pavement analysis. And the report stated that 21% of Sandpoint's roads are rated as poor or very poor.
Yes.
So I guess everybody that drives around this town knows we have some street problems.
Yes, we have. This is one of not as life altering or critical as water quality. But yes, our streets are a problem. And, if you're tuning in, the bottom line is we don't have money to fix them. I'll go into that in just a moment, but let's just talk about poor and very poor. It's hard to visualize what that means. That probably doesn't mean anything to someone out there in radio land, but poor and very poor basically mean that if you've seen a street that looks like an alligator back, where the asphalt is maybe cracked in 10 or 8 inch pieces, and it's just fractured all throughout. Think of the worst streets that you drive in Sandpoint. Those are the poor and very poor. And when we look at our streets in Sandpoint, there's two problems. One, many of them were built during a time when the city was just sort of, hand to mouth. We were a pretty small, I don't mean this in a bad way, but not super sophisticated in how we were planning our capital improvement plans and our projects. So many of the streets don't have something called road base or fabric. When you build a street today, you put down, you excavate, you put down a woven fabric, then you put very large rock, maybe fist or larger size, and then you put fine gravel on top of that and compact it. So you build a very stable road base, then you put your asphalt layers down. Without that, and because of the 300 feet of clay we sit on, our roads that were built the way they used to build roads literally fall into the clay. The clay is like, just think of it as quicksand. So many of our streets don't have that foundation under them. And the real vexing problem then, the challenge is, we've got about $1.5 million a year between the revenue coming from our lodging tax and our general fund to put into streets, street specifics. So $1.5 million does about a block, maybe of a full rebuild if you do it properly. If you're just, and that's excavating, putting that fabric down in the road base, doing it right. So a road that's going to last for decades. It'll still need maintenance, but decades. Alternatively, $1.5 million might put some new and a new 2 inches of asphalt on top of some of these poor and very poor roads. But in another 5 years, 6 years, those roads are going to be cracked and settling and broken again. So it's a really a challenge of where do we put our money, the most bang for the buck. The bottom line is $1.5 million a year is not enough to, maintain our streets. Even, you know, if we don't find another revenue source, our street conditions continue to go down and degrade. So, we've done some things this year. I had Public Works buy something called a Dura Patcher. Typically when there's a crack or a pothole, they'll put a shovel of hot asphalt in and tamp it down and call it good. And we all know what happens, you know, the next freeze-thaw cycle, that thing's blown out and the pothole's back. So this Durapatcher actually mixes hot oil and gravel and it layers it in. It sprays it out there. And then they roll it with a mini steamroller. It's a much more, you know, solid patch and it can fill some of our cracks. So you've seen that throughout town. I told them to wear it out, make that thing run as many days a week as you can. And, you know, it's a Band-Aid. It helps. But at the end of the day, we will be hopefully Wednesday, the council, a week from today, the council will be authorizing the placement of a local option tax, a 1% local option tax on the ballot, for strictly dedication to fund our streets. And what that will do is allow us to have a dedicated funding source. My hope is they let that go on for 25 years. And this will, for the next 25 years, just remove this issue from discussion, basically. We'll have funding. We'll know we're just going to fix every street and sidewalk in town. And basically take that off the table so we can focus on other things.
Okay, we want to dig on that. But first, Susie has to tell people who we are.
Well, this is 88.5 KRFY, your community radio station. This is the Wednesday morning show with Chris and Susie. And we're presenting City Talk with our mayor, Jeremy Grimm. Thanks for being here. And we're hearing all about sewers and wastewater and street fixing with the local option tax.
Yeah, so you're proposing a local option tax. The council needs to approve this.
Yes.
And they don't have much time to do that because to get it on the ballot, it has to be approved by, I think, September 6th is what
that's right. Yeah, September 6th, we have to send the language to the county so they can prepare it for the November election.
Mm-hmm. So, and there's a couple of different schemes. We're not unfamiliar with the local option tax. That was a tax that was used to finance the rebuild and grandstands at Memorial Field. It was a 1% tax that was added onto retail sales within the city limits. Pondere right now has a local option 1% tax
right.
As well. And they're using it to do a lot of big projects over there. Well, so that's one way to go, but then there is another way to do it is to have a tax that just ran 6 months of 2%. And so give us the rationale between these two different schemes here.
Sure. So if you're unfamiliar, in Idaho, our state statutes allow towns that are designated as resort cities to go to the voters and ask them to impose a local option tax. There's not a limit on how many percentage that could be. There's not really a limit on what we use that for or the duration of how long that tax will run. That statute requires a 60% approval of that tax. So to qualify as a resort city and for this option for a local tax, you have to be under 10,000 residents. And they measure that at the census. So our next census will be 2030, and we'll definitely be over 10,000 people unless something horrific happens. So we have a very short time period, a couple of years left, to bring this proposition to the voters. When looking at this, how long do you run it for? What's the best, you know, targeted projects for it? There's a lot to consider. I know in the past, you know, I've heard from friends and citizens, you know, I support it for this, but not for that. We've floated option taxes on the ballot several times in Sandpoint. It did pass for Memorial Field. It was very specific to what the tax was going to fund. And in my opinion, my belief is that if you're specific and clear, then people, and if they support that project, they'll support the tax. One of the great things about the local option tax is that it's paid by not just by Sandpoint residents. It's paid by people who shop from Bonner County or visitors to our region. So looking at how do we structure this, do we run it as a year-round tax at 1%? That's one option. I started looking at the numbers, the collections from our previous local option tax. And what I saw was that the months of June, July, August, and September, that tax actually more than doubled. And that reflects the influx of tourists and visitors to our community. So we know that if we really wanted to put you know, this tax out where the visitors were paying the majority of it, we would just do it those months. Alternatively, we could have it year round. We discussed this at the city council last week. The pros and cons, obviously the pros of having it just in the summer are it really targets tourists. The cons are if you're a retailer, you know, every 6 months you have to go in there and change your vending machine and make sure the tax is on and whoops, now it's coming off. There's a lot of auditing. There's a lot of, confirmation from the city. Is every retailer paying it now? Is every retailer have it off? So I think I've come around to the point where probably a 1% tax year round is the simplest. I like to focus on keep it simple, stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, just keep it really simple and clear, just for streets and sidewalks and pathways, and just, you know, year round at 1%. So I'm hopeful that's what the council will approve for the ballot language. And at that point, I need to get out personally and explain the details of this throughout the community. The city cannot advocate and say vote yes. We can't spend money to say vote yes on a proposition, but we can educate and we can give residents and businesses the background. Walking around town, communicating with friends and businesses. I hear from a lot of people. I've yet to run into someone who would not like to fix our roads. And the truth of it is barring a new revenue source, the city doesn't have money to fix our roads. And I'll jump into that super quickly here. In Idaho, our taxes for the city, our property taxes, we're capped at 3% per year. We can increase our revenue from property taxes 3% a year. That amounts actually new dollars each year at City Hall to about $150,000. With that $150,000, myself and the council have to pay for a cost of living adjustment for our 100 plus employees. We have to pay for every year employees get more proficient in their job. We have a range and step salary program where you start at a low range and if you are proficient, you bump up. So we have actual position cost increase for people getting better at their job. And then finally, we have, like anyone else, inflation, the cost of health insurance, property insurance, and related benefits. That eats up our $150,000 of new money every year. And in fact, we have to dip into our other revenue each year to continue to maintain what we have. So we have no new money to do roads. We have about $1.5 million a year. And I, some voters out there and business might say, wait, we passed a tax to help with the roads a couple of years ago. And we did. We passed, the residents were very generous. They passed a lodging tax. So if you stay in a hotel or a short-term rental in Sandpoint, that tax went from 7 to 14%. That generates about $1 million a year for us. So that's how we get to our $1.5 million a year of road improvements, thanks to that. That tax comes off in 2035. It goes away again. So we really don't have a funding mechanism to fix our roads. And that puts me in a position of where do we put this $1.5 million a year? Do we do a full rebuild of our roads and build a block and a half that's going to last for 20 years? Or do we throw down 2 inches of asphalt and try to cover up a bunch of, you know, cracked, potholed roads that we know are going to literally fall into the ground in another 4 years after we do that?
So you might not have caught it, but how much do you expect the 1% tax to raise over the course of a year?
Yeah. So we know that when it was in place for War Memorial Field, Barlow Stadium, it was generating about $1.5 million a year. Speaking to some of the large retailers in Sandpoint, between the time we had our last tax and today, they've seen their sales increase almost by 100%. Wow. So the way the state works, they don't tell us what there's no entity, the State Division of Tax, they won't tell us what our sales are in the city. But we can kind of assume that based on growth and inflation, this could generate between $2.5 and $3 million a year. So 25 years starts to put us in the ballpark of, you know, $75 to $100 million, which is basically what our analysis shows that we need to put into our roads to bring them up to a national standard.
Okay. Well, we're going to find out, I guess, on Wednesday, if the council is going to approve this to be put on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Get any sense for how the wind's blowing there?
You know, we had a great discussion at our last council meeting. Some of the areas of the discussion were, well, should we also include other things in this? What about art? What about parks? What about housing? You know, are we being too narrow and too focused on just roads? You know, I think it was a good discussion, but my sense was that the general preference of the council was to keep it simple, roads. And one of the things—
The KISS principle.
Yeah, yes.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, so one of the other things, of course, is the duration of this. Now, once we hit 10,000, a population of 10,000, we no longer have the option to levy a local option tax.
Unless the legislature were to bump that limit up from 10,000 to 15,000, say,
right,
and redefine the resort city.
Yeah. Correct. So every year there's discussion down in Boise about should cities have the ability to leverage a local option tax? There are proponents and there are opponents. Every year there are people who want to increase the population limits and let towns and cities of, you know, 15,000 do it. There's also folks who say, no, you know, these local communities are out of control. And I don't quite understand the rationale for not letting people do it, but
let people decide in their own municipality, right, if they
government,
want to have the tax,
yeah,
or not.
Yeah. Closest, right, to the people is best. But my point is that I want to get this out there. And Haley, Idaho, they were about to exceed their population limit, and they went out for a long duration. I don't know if it was 20 or 25 years, but that's one of the things I want to do is put this out for 25 years and basically lock it in, lock in our ability to do this. We can always take it off if we determine that we've met our national standards for our roads, but get it while the getting's good and strike while the iron's hot.
Okay.
Very good.
Well, that's a good explanation of this proposed local option tax, which pretty good chance that voters will be deciding that matter in the November 5th election.
Right.
But I wanted to ask another question about an issue that came up during the budgeting process, and that is the city's contract with the Better Together Animal Alliance shelter, yep, to take care of stray dogs. Mm-hmm. And what's the disposition there? The BTAA came back with a really big increase.
3,000%.
Yeah. They because they did an analysis and they found that the number of dogs that they're taking in from the city, because the city has a statutory requirement to take care of stray dogs, was, in their estimation, was costing them $65,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And the city's last year, I believe, paid $2,400. Mm-hmm. We did have Mandy Evans on a mm-hmm. few shows ago, and she talked about this.
Yep.
So, as I understand, she wasn't really advocating that necessarily that the city up the contract if there's another means of taking care of the animals. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do we treat stray animals? And does the city, if they undertake that that task of taking care of these strays, what happens with them? So yeah. I guess what's the plan? Because I assume that that an increase in the contract wasn't approved.
No, we did not budget $60,000+ for that service.
Mandy said, "Well, we're only coming in for about half that for the first
time out." Yeah, she
inched it up.
They proposed a couple different options. Let me just step back for a second. So, the first thing that people have to understand is just like our service providers who provide bullets, fuel, cars, tires, paper clips. The city has policy and their state policy that we go out to bids. We don't just pick, one entity to provide a service for us. Anything over $5,000, we need to get written bids or solicitations, price comparison.
It's a law, basically.
It's a law and it's good practice.
Yeah, sure.
So first and foremost, we can't just say, yes, we're going to accept a $30,000 or $60,000 service request to take care of stray animals. So that's the first thing, is we have to put this out. The city did increase its budget from, I will absolutely agree, it was far too low, $20-something hundred a year. We increased it to almost $7,000 a year. So we, 300% increase. When we look at our obligations under Idaho code, we had our attorneys look at it. I've read all the statutes. The police chiefs read all the statutes. This is one of those sort of unfunded government mandates. But if you look at the code, it says that if we have a dog licensing program and it's enforced, then the city shall be responsible for taking care of stray animals. Well, we have a dog licensing program. I don't know about you two and if you have animals, but I know many people. Let me just put it this way. It's not our most popular service that we provide at City Hall. There are thousands of dogs in Sandpoint and a few hundred licensed dogs. Mm-hmm. So it's not working. And we're looking at maybe tweaking our code to eliminate that licensing program. That would absolve us of having to statutorily be responsible for stray dogs. But there's a bigger issue here, which is what dogs are we contracting for services? And I'll put it into two categories. There are the dogs that our police and our community resource officers pick up on the streets, literally put them in the police vehicle or the other vehicles and bring them to the shelter. The number of those dogs is I might have this wrong. It's about 45 that our police believe that we turned in last year. Okay. There are the other kind of stray dogs. We have some very good Samaritans who see a dog and they proactively say, I'm going to be a good person. I'm going to grab this dog. Oh, it doesn't have a collar. I'm going to take it to the shelter.
It's within the city limits. Yeah.
Correct. Right. So we have, I'll call them do-gooders. Some of those do-gooders return multiple dogs a year. It's almost like a passion of theirs. In fact, I know there are several individuals who have turned in multiple dogs a year. Those are not dogs that the city is collecting or acting on. That's not a service. That's a separate. And then we have the problem of if you live out, say, Colburn Culver, out in the county, and you bring a stray dog in and you tell the intake person, where'd you find this dog? Where do you live? I live in Sandpoint, 83864. Well, that's technically accurate. They live in a zip code and their postal code, Sandpoint. Do they live in the city of Sandpoint limits? And that detail is unclear at times. Now, our police chief has and the city would like to get information from everyone turning in a stray dog. Because if we know that Chris Bessler has turned in a, picked up a stray dog, well, I'm sorry, recovered a stray dog, your dog was stray, you go to the shelter, you pick it up. We, as the police, would like to fine you and recover our costs. If you have a stray dog, we would go to Chris and say, Chris, your dog was stray, it got picked up. We're going to charge you $150. Don't have another stray dog. The shelter doesn't want to give us that information because there is a belief that if we go and now fine people, or if people know there's going to be a $150 fine for having a stray dog, they might not pick up their dog. So we don't have the clear information of the dogs and the owners. That's just one example of the challenge that we're facing. So to put a bow on this and sort of bring it to conclusion, we are budgeting for to provide this service. Our police are going to be putting out a proposal to businesses and the public. Does anyone want to provide this service? We're going to look at a cost per dog for dogs that are turned in by Sandpoint Police. We know that if we do the numbers of the contract that Better Together put out, it ended up being close to $700 per dog. Well, we know that we can go to a doggy hotel for $50 a night and board a dog for five nights for far less than that $750 per dog. So between a variety of means, our police are going to try to actually home these dogs if we take one in. We will actually get a scanner. We'll find the chips if they have chips. We'll actually try to return those dogs internally. We'll educate the public about dogs at large. And we'll find a provider that can meet our needs. And if we fail to do that, we will have to increase the budget. But we believe that we can find a provider that will meet our budgeted dollar amount for the service.
It's comprehensive.
And I got to say, we will not euthanize dogs. Somebody told me the other day, I heard Jeremy wants to kill the dogs.
Well, I mean, you're only required to hold them for 5 to 7 days, and then you could euthanize them.
We could.
5 days, but you've got to work in some weekends there.
So it's official, you will not euthanize dogs, no matter what.
Or geese.
Or geese.
I am not a goose or dog killer.
Speaking of dogs, how are the dogs that are patrolling the beach working out? I saw one day running after them, and those geese were like very aware of that dog.
I tell you, this is one of the coolest things. One of my positions is, sure, come to me with complaints. That's fine. It's my job as mayor. But come to me with a solution. Like, okay, you see a problem. What's the solution? Pretend you're sitting up here. What are you going to do about it? So with this geese at City Beach issue, some people came, Jane Fritz and others, and I said, what's the solution? And it's an amazing solution the public came up with. So it's working super well. It's so intuitive. We know that geese run away from predators. Jason Welker and the public have put together, he's our community and planning development director. He's put together with the public this training program. It's a official permitted group of dogs that goes out there. They walk the beach a couple times a day, and it seems to be working amazingly well. So hopefully this is the simple solution that we've been looking for forever.
Success.
Staring us in the face. And I got to say, there's less goose poop on the lawns now.
Yeah.
I'm so busy, I unfortunately don't get to spend a lot of time at City Beach. I did lose my sunglasses down there last week when Lady Liberty went down. So if anyone found those, please contact me.
Prescription. Okay, real quick. Liberty.
We want to know.
Lady Liberty down because there was some, wiring issues?
No. So Lady Liberty is an aluminum, iconic, statue, piece of art in our community. And it's made out of aluminum, so aluminum is not the strongest metal. It's on a base with a couple bolts down there, and people jump on it, people lean on it, kids.
They take their pictures with it?
Yeah. So it gets a lot of love. And at the end of the day, I got a call from a concerned citizen the other day, last Saturday, that said, boy, it's about to fall. It's going to hurt someone. So we removed it. We're welding on a new plate on the bottom. We're taking her to an auto body shop, getting her repainted, and she's going to get reinstalled probably in about a month or so, a month and a half, and she'll be good to go for another decade,
hopefully. It's kind of funny. That has turned into an iconic little part of our town.
You know, Creme came up. They said it was the most viewed story on their site, Creme 2. So, yeah, it's clearly something that people care a lot
about. Okay, we got 2 minutes here. I'm going to ask you two questions. First, any status on the James Russell Sports Center? Got an opening date for that?
Mid-November.
Okay.
Yep.
And how about the skate park? Is that...
That's open.
It's open. Is this construction pretty complete?
We're going to work on some paving of the parking lot and just some minor landscaping around it. But yeah, it's busy. It's open. Thanks for all the volunteers and folks who helped donate to make that happen.
Okay.
It's really cool over there, by the way.
And second quick question. Is there a plan for cleanup of the old Army surplus site?
You know, that's private property. My last update on that was that the landowner is working with his insurance company to, you know, do the estimate and figure out what they're going to pay to bring in the bulldozers and take all that away.
It's going to be a project, but it's kind of a mess. Well, Mayor Jeremy Graham, thank you for coming in and filling us in on so much happening with the city.
We fully expect you to come back in a couple months, another City Talk update, because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, no, I'm always available, always enjoy coming down and speaking to you. You have great questions I'm sure the public wants to know more about. So if you're bored, come down to a city council meeting and watch it on YouTube or Zoom. And swing on down City Hall and let us know how you're doing.
I think the Sandpoint Chamber is having a State of the Cities general membership meeting on September 12th. So folks could come and hear you give a lot more detail on these things to that chamber meeting on September 12th. You can look it up at sandpointchamber.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Mayor Grimm, for coming in and sharing everything with us this morning.
You bet. Have a great day out there.